Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can we learn about the monumental battle for equal rights regardless of race in America by going to its historic front lines in person? While millions of U.S. college students were planning or engaging in the standard spring break debauchery this month, more than 30 SMU students chose instead to embark on a tour that took them through Montgomery, Birmingham, and Selma, Alabama, Oxford, Mississippi, Memphis, Tennessee, and Little Rock, Arkansas. The trip is organized by the Office of the Chaplain and open to students of Professor Dennis Simon's senior-level public opinion and American politics class. He joins us now to discuss the experience, along with Ray Jordan, an alumnus of the pilgrimage as a graduate student who has served for the past 6 years as trip leader, and Emily Mankowski, an SMU senior majoring in human rights, who was among the students in attendance this year. Welcome, all of you, to Think.
Thank you.
So, Dennis, how did the idea for this trip originate, and why a partnership between the political science department and the chaplain's office?
Essentially, this trip first started as an enrichment activity for spring break, and it operated that way successfully for 3 years. And then the chaplain at the time, Will Finnan, decided, what if we build a course around this? Students could get course credit plus the experience. So he approached me to design a course, largely because I had a discussion with him about Delta blues music in Mississippi. And then Ray was invited to be the director and lead the trip. And that's how it started, sponsored by the chaplain, but built around an academic offering.
So how were the destinations chosen?
The destinations were chosen primarily, initially, because we thought, you know, there were some particular battles that were fought that led to legislation. And so those sites were of particular interest. And then talking closely with Dr. Simon about what he would be offering in the academic course. So whatever he would be highlighting in class, we wanted to make sure we included those sites along the way.
It must be wonderful to know that that's coming, that sort of reinforcement, to the extent that you, I mean, do you almost hold something back and think, this is really going to hit home when we go to this place?
Yes. What I guess we strive for is a basic familiarity with the events and the places. Where ours differs, and we crisscross a lot of tours through the South during spring break, is through the efforts of the founders and then later Ray, we speak with people who were participants in these events in many places. So, for example, in Selma, we meet with Joanne Bland, who is, as an 11-year-old, was beaten on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. So there's a layer of richness in this that goes beyond the simple familiarity you get out of the classroom and the explanations and the like.
What did you expect, Emily, before you went on the trip?
Well, I've been on several human rights trips with SMU before, and everyone, past pilgrims on the trip that we like to call them, say you're going to have an aha moment where everything's going to come together and it's really going to be a life-changing experience. And for a student who's had similar experiences before, I kind of felt like, well, is it really going to happen again? Like, how many aha moments can I have? But we all kind of were, like, waiting for that moment to happen. And I think we all had it in some way. There is definitely a moment or several moments on the trip where you take what we've learned from the class and we watch documentaries as we're going to these different cities. And then we get to the cities and then we meet people who are involved in different actions when in the 50s and 60s where this took place. And it all just comes full circle.
What was your aha moment?
Whew. I think my first aha moment was when we were in Montgomery, Alabama, and we met with Reverend Gretz and his wife. And they he's a Lutheran minister, a white Lutheran minister who preached or was pastor at an all-black church in Montgomery, Alabama in the 50s. And he and his wife since then have been proponents of all different kinds of civil and human rights issues and meeting with people, they're in their 80s now, who were so ahead of their time in many ways back then and still ahead of their time at their age. It really kind of, it just, it gave me a lot of hope for the future and for people to consider human rights to be more of an important issue in today's world.
Is there a sense that some of these trips, some of these visits have to take place now with this generation? Because by the time, you know, Emily's kids are in college, there won't be very many people alive who have firsthand experience of all this.
Absolutely. We like to call persons who were firsthand witnesses foot soldiers. Mm-hmm. We know, of course, very famous names like Dr. King and Rosa Parks. And from what many students hear, particularly in public school textbooks, Rosa sat down, Martin made a speech, and it was all kumbaya after that. And we understand.
Too bad it didn't work out that way, isn't it?
Yeah, not quite that simple.
Yeah.
And so we understand that there were just numerous people, myriad numbers of people mm-hmm. who were involved in making change. And so one of the things we want to do with students is I try to prep them for the trip. I tell them that, you know, when you're sitting in class, it becomes a history lesson. It's a history lesson. It's about what happened back then. But somewhere along the trip, you have your aha moment. You have a moment in which you now become a character in the thick plot of this drama. And when you leave the trip, you are equipped with an overwhelming sense that the revolution continues, that our efforts and progress towards true equality for all persons, regardless of gender, of sexuality, of race, of ethnicity, of nationality or religion, that struggle really does continue. And so now, as a character in this drama, you now pick up the reins, you take the story to the next chapter, and you continue the struggle in your own individual and collective way.
We use a parting quote as we get off the bus Saturday night from Elie Wiesel: those who hear a witness themselves become a witness. Hmm. And so that's the transmission you were talking about. Because our fear, and it's going to be realized, is that a lot of these people aren't going to be around for the next generation of students. And so they are so anxious, such warmth, that they are passing these stories along. And everybody picks up on that.
So students have to be approved, Dennis, by you in order to take the course. What are you looking for? I'm sure there are some prerequisites, but are there sort of character qualities you're looking for?
Not really. I do that simply to be upfront that this isn't Padre Island
right.
on a bus.
Mm-hmm.
And just get a chance to talk to students and let them know what a commitment this is, both the class as well as the trip. And generally, that's enough. You could tell right away, yes, I want to do this. Others will say, maybe I'll look for another Thursday night class. This isn't exactly what I want. But that's the purpose. It's not a character test or anything. But it is a commitment, and I want to make sure that students know that going in.
Did you have friends, Emily, who said, this is amazing, I wish I could go? Or did you have friends who said, what, you're giving up your very last spring break as an undergrad?
Well, actually, I'm a junior, so
oh, okay.
I have one more spring break that maybe I could go to Padre, but I haven't gone yet in my undergrad career. No, most of my friends actually are, a lot of my friends are in the human rights mm-hmm. program, and most of my friends were either going on the trip in class with me or had been before, and we're all telling me, oh my gosh, this is going to be an amazing experience, you're going to love it. And we have before we leave, we have a send-off, and a lot of the past pilgrims come and wish us like good luck on our journey because they know how great it's going to be. But I did have friends coming back who didn't know I was going on the trip. They're like, oh, what did you do for spring break? I said, oh, I went on a civil rights pilgrimage, and I got some looks like, well, what's that? Or was that for a class? Or, oh my gosh, that sounds exhausting. And for me, though, it's what I love to do. So it wasn't, yes, it might be tiring spending almost the entire day on the bus, but the reward that you get from it is so much more.
How does the trip change, Ray, from year to year based on the makeup of the student body in attendance?
Well, I really have to say this year's makeup was a bit different than it's been in past years because SMU, you know, congrats to SMU, has just moved the human rights program from a minor to a major and has included this trip as a mandatory course offering in order to get a major in human rights. And so I think this year we had more students that were human rights majors who had been to Rwanda, who had been to Auschwitz, who had been to Cambodia and a number of other human rights destinations. And so the makeup this year, I think, was a bit more serious. These were students who understood that they had a part in making the world a better place, being the change they really wanted to see or they want to see in the world. And so from year to year, if we have more graduate students, and at times we do, we have Masters of Liberal Studies students who have really taken this trip and made it their own in a variety of ways. And so sometimes when you have persons who have lived through these years as students who have come back to graduate school, it sometimes brings a different texture and richness. This year we had quite a few of human rights majors, which again brings another level of intensity and seriousness to the trip. And in years past, we've had a variety of students from a variety of majors, because we always try to make sure, even though about 85% to 95% of the trip are persons in Dr. Simon's class, that we always leave some room for persons who just opt to take it still as an enrichment opportunity during their spring break. And so we have a variety of knowledge levels and of persons who are familiar with the history. And then we have people who really have kind of heard on the peripheral about this civil rights movement and feel that it's something they want to do for their own personal enrichment. And so those dynamics really help to change the trip from year to year.
I would imagine the conversation on the bus that in between destinations when the documentary is over is some of the most fruitful of the trip.
Yes, it is. And we also built in what we call reflection periods, where we specifically set aside an hour of time when we're in the hotel and could get a room where we reflect on what we've done. And those things are magnificent because it pulls in your reaction to the place, your reaction to the people, your reaction to what you already know. And just to add to Ray's, I don't compare the classes because every class is unique and different over the 6 years. But what I'm proud of is SMU has left a footprint all over the South. And we're told a number of times this time, this is my favorite group to speak with. They're knowledgeable. They get it. And so it's just, simply put, a source of pride to know that the groups of students we take out has left an impression as much as the places and people we've met have left an impression on us.
Absolutely. And I, of course, went on this trip as a graduate student, not a part of any academic course. I grew up with my grandmother, and so I always felt like I had this connection to a generation that was a couple of steps before me. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to go on the trip because I thought, you know what? Again, these are persons who may not be here to speak with us in years to come. In fact, they won't be here to speak with us in years to come. And I wanted to do it for my own personal enrichment. Well, that had a fundamental change and impact on my life. I went on. I'm completing my PhD now, in which the civil rights movement the lessons from the civil rights movement is a huge part of that. I teach courses in the School of Urban and Public Affairs at UT Arlington, in which I include this history and lessons from it in those courses. And so I think that this trip has a tremendous impact on the pilgrims as they go forward in their careers.
Ray Jordan is with us. He's a leader of SMU's annual Civil Rights Pilgrimage, along with Dennis Simon, Altshuler Distinguished Teaching Professor of Political Science at SMU, and Emily Mankowski. She's a member of the SMU Honors Program and a major in human rights who attended this year's pilgrimage. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. SMU.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about SMU's annual Civil Rights Pilgrimage with Dennis Simon, who is Altshuler Distinguished Teaching Professor of Political Science at SMU and a founder of the trip. Ray Jordan, a leader of the trip who began as an alum of the program. And Emily Mankowski, a member of the SMU Honors Program and a junior, majoring in human rights, who just has completed the visit this year. If you'd like to join the conversation, perhaps share a story of your own visiting this part of the country, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So as part of my research to understand what everybody went through, there are some blog posts that students have done for the past couple of years. And I was really struck by people's responses to visiting Martin Luther King's home and being struck by how very ordinary it was and understanding for the first time that this person that we've made into almost a supernatural figure was a human being who had to deal with the same kind of human struggles as everybody else. And I wonder, maybe you can speak to whether that was something that touched you, Emily.
Yes, it was. You walk into his home and it's they have it now as kind of a period museum. So most of the furniture that's there is furniture that he used or replicas of what would have been used at the time. And it's a very humble little house that the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church built for all of their pastors. So since Martin Luther King, other pastors have lived there. And walking through, I mean, our group of like 35 students fitting into this tiny house makes the humility of the environment more apparent. I think what a lot of students reacted to was when we went into the kitchen where Martin Luther King had a revelation about the movement. I don't know if you want to speak on it more, Dr. Simon or Ray.
Well, it's called the Epiphany, kind of is the name it's been deemed in history. After receiving a particularly threatening phone call, this is during the Montgomery bus boycott. I love the story of Dr. King. He's 24 years old. He has just finished his coursework at Boston University towards his PhD, and he says to Coretta, his new bride, "I really want to find a small, quiet little community where I can serve the people, serve the community, and finish writing my dissertation." And so he chose Montgomery, Alabama. Little did he know, a year later, Rosa Parks would not give up her seat, sparking a citywide boycott of the bus line, and he would be asked to lead that, thus thrusting him to national and international fame or infamy, depending on who you're asking. And so here he is, very young. And so our students really, I think, are taken by how young he was. I think he's 26 by this time, and he has a newborn. His house has been bombed. He's receiving death threats. And so one night he receives a particularly threatening phone call. And this time it really bothered him. And so he retires to the kitchen in the middle of the night, pours himself a cup of coffee, and he begins to pray, saying to himself, you know, God, I'm trying to be strong. I'm trying to do what I really think is the right thing to do. But I have a young family. I don't know if I can do this. And an inner voice that he describes as being the voice of God comes to him and says, "Martin Luther, stand up for righteousness. Stand up for justice. I am with you. Don't be afraid." And from that moment on, that kind of existential experience that he has changes him. And he was able to lead the next almost 15 years of what we know as the modern civil rights movement as a person that was fearless in the face of threats, in the face of actually being stabbed in New York City. He had nearly lost his life in New York City and lived daily with the dark cloud of death around him. Yet he could do so fearlessly after having that experience. And so in the museum, they actually hear a recording of him speaking about this in a particular sermon or speech he was given.
And just to give you the texture of our trip, three doors down from the parsonage is a home owned by the Harris family. The father at the time was the black pharmacist in the city and coordinated rides during the bus boycott. Secondly, in 1961, that is where the Freedom Riders were hidden after they were beat up at the Montgomery bus station. And in 1965, the daughters of that family participated in the Selma to Montgomery march. We meet with Mrs. Harris, Dr. Velda Montgomery, who's one of the daughters, when we're there. And Dr. Montgomery has written a book called Just a Neighbor, in which she describes her experiences running through the King Parsonage as a young woman.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Adele who says, first, do you see a difference in the reactions of African-American students versus white students? Second, is the pilgrimage open to others who are not SMU students?
The pilgrimage has been open primarily to persons of the SMU community. Now, if you have a connection to that community, I have actually had a friend of mine that was a classmate in my PhD program who was from New York City, from Manhattan. She flew to Dallas just to go on this trip with us. But she had a connection clearly to the SMU community. So it's open primarily to the SMU community and friends thereof. However, the reaction that you have from different students of different ethnicities is telling. Oftentimes, we have a difficult time getting African-American students to go, particularly those who are not a part of the class. There's an element of embarrassment and shame when you see footage of persons who look like you, who come from similar backgrounds that you do, being treated in such dehumanizing ways. And as a 19 or 20 or 21-year-old who may not have that as much self-awareness as they will grow into in later years, it sometimes is quite difficult to do that in a multicultural environment. Oftentimes, we have white students who feel shame. They are ashamed that persons who look like them and come from backgrounds similar to theirs could act in such a dehumanizing way. And so, but towards the end of the trip, that's why I think that the office of the chaplain being the spearhead of the experience or the experiential learning portion is important, because the office wanted to make sure that we had reflection periods so that people could speak and could kind of get things off of their chest. Because really, I think some of the most important conversations that happen are in the hotel at night with roommates who are of a variety of cultures and backgrounds and religions, and then bringing those conversations together in three directed reflection periods where people can really talk. And by the end of the trip, I think we see a transformation that happens that wasn't there quite clearly at the beginning.
It's so interesting because I hadn't really thought about that. I had understood that you might, you know, stand outside Central High School and understand what, you know, students must have felt like. It didn't occur to me that what would come out of this was students saying, oh, now I get how you feel about all this. Now I understand the contemporary perspective on this. So that's really interesting.
Well, we talked to Stephen Black while we're on the trip. Stephen Black is the director of the University of Alabama's Center for Ethics and Social Responsibility. He just so happens to also be the grandson of Hugo Black. And Hugo Black was a Supreme Court justice, formerly an Alabama senator to the U.S. Senate, who was a card-carrying member of the KKK, because in order to be elected in that part of our history from Alabama, you needed to be a part of particular social groups, and the KKK was deemed an appropriate one. But he was one of the Supreme Court justices that signed off on Brown v. Board of Education, which was a key decision from the court that banned or dismantled segregation in schools. And so we talked to Stephen Black, who's returned to Alabama to do this very important work, and he really helps to bring some clarity around charity versus justice. You know, charity is kind of what we do a couple of times a year on a Saturday morning to make ourselves feel good about the privileges that we have. Charity is something we do during spring break if we go and we build houses in Mexico, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that. We need that. But justice really does seek to change or alter the institutional, the structural barriers that perpetuate some of the injustices that we find in our world. And so our students, particularly, I think, after talking to him, really helped to connect the dots that that was then, yet there's lots of work yet to do mm-hmm. today as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Emily, I'm curious about your emotions, your reactions at Central High in Little Rock and also at Ole Miss. Given that you were, you know, these are places that are were really engaged in history with people around your age.
Mm-hmm. Well, Central High School was the first significant place that we visited on the trip. And when you go there, the high school looks exactly the same as it did back in the 50s, this kind of gigantic, imposing building, and you can only imagine what it felt to the Little Rock Nine walking up to that building that where they knew they weren't going to be greeted with any happy faces. But what was interesting when we visited, there was some sort of ROTC group running around up on the steps and around the campus, and there were Black students, Latina students, white students all running around together and kind of sitting up on the different levels of the school. And we just kind of look at each other like 50 years ago, you would have never seen that. Mm-hmm. But everything around Little Rock High School, it was a very interesting feeling because there were not many people around and many of the buildings still look like what they would have back in the 50s. So it almost feels like you're transported back in time. And walking up the steps in our group this year, I think particularly Dr. Simon and Ray have noted that it was very diverse. We have students from all different kinds of backgrounds, and us all being together at the high school at this moment, I think just kind of makes you realize how important the Little Rock Nine integrating that school was in our history, and that without that, this we would never have this diversity today. As far as Ole Miss, it was a very kind of disappointing a little bit because I think there are a lot of the segregation is over, but I think a lot of prejudices still exist in this particular part of the country. And I know in recent news, Ole Miss has had a couple instances of maybe race-related riots. We had a professor in the journalism department there kind of talk about what's happened just this past year. What kind of steps are being made to kind of mend these differences among the students? I don't know if either Ray or Dr. Simon, you'd like to touch on that.
It was a shouting match. It got out of hand on election night. And Ole Miss, when they make news, it goes national. And this was one of the instances in which Dr. Marvin King, explained. But Ole Miss is dealing with a layer of things from their rebel mascot.
There's still people who don't want the mascot to have been changed.
Exactly. And so what you do see is that institution coming to grips with its history. And coming to grips with history is not always comfortable or pleasant. And we've observed that over the years.
Because there's a difference between tradition and tradition that offends. And sometimes those are difficult conversations to have. The Confederate flag, is that a tradition, a symbol of one's tradition and one's heritage, or is that an offensive emblem in today's culture?
You feel like people who say it's just tradition, it means nothing except tradition, do you feel like that's sort of deliberately putting blinders on? Is there any other way to interpret that?
Well, I think that not just Ole Miss, but if we looked at it from a much broader context, mm-hmm. we really have to have a more deliberative and communicative democracy where we talk to each other. And I think that is probably the jewel of this trip, that we have students from a variety of backgrounds, international students, black, white, religious, a variety of religious affiliations or no religion at all. And they go on this experience together because this is not black history. And Dr. Simon is always so careful to point that out.
It's American history.
It's not Southern history. It's American history, right? And so as Americans, we have to, I think, understand the parts of our history that make us feel very proud and honorable and parts of our history that make us understand that we've not always been perfect and we've struggled some along the way. And so I think that through conversations about our history, our American history, then people might come to understand that some symbols are offensive, but we're not always willing to have those conversations.
What's the best way when you're in class, Dennis, when a hard conversation has to happen? Are there particular questions you throw out there to sort of get the ball rolling? Do you begin with a lecture and hope someone will raise their hand?
Basically, it's an interactive presentation mm-hmm. and discussion. My fundamental goal is, apart from the content, is for people to try to understand how this period of time, number one, spurred other movements, almost simultaneous. Mm-hmm. The farm workers movement, the women's movement. And number two, to understand how those movements fundamentally define what our politics is like today. And that's what we get at. And when difficult questions arise, I put them in that context. I am not advertising a way of looking at the world. I'm advertising a framework in which they could look at the world and draw their own conclusions.
My guests this hour are Dennis Simon, Altshuler Distinguished Teaching Professor of Political Science at SMU, Ray Jordan, leader of the Civil Rights Pilgrimage Trip, and Emily Mankowski, an SMU honors student majoring in human rights who went on the pilgrimage this year. We will return to the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us or maybe share one of your own experiences, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour after this year's SMU Civil Rights Pilgrimage with Ray Jordan, trip leader, Dennis Simon, who is a teaching professor of political science at SMU, and Emily Mankowski, who went on the trip this year. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Interesting email here from Lydia in Fort Worth, who wants to know if you have any tips for taking a family road trip to some of these sites. Are there any that are must-see stops that are particularly appropriate for elementary-age children?
All of the large museums are very child-friendly. So if you were in, of course, Memphis, that is the National Civil Rights Museum, located at the assassination site, unfortunately, the Lorraine Motel, assassination site of Dr. King, very child-friendly. Birmingham has a very child-friendly, a huge museum that first time we'd visited the museum in several years, and we were quite impressed with the updates. Very child-friendly. And then Montgomery, actually at the Rosa Parks Museum, they have a whole wing dedicated to children. And so it's a very child-friendly or young person-friendly environment.
Can you walk the march routes, and are there sort of markers along the way or anything special if one was to do that?
Our particular route is Little Rock, and then we swing through Mississippi. There really aren't any museums or tourist-like attractions in Mississippi that pertains specifically to the history that we study. However, there are persons that we like to speak to while we're there. Mm-hmm. But when you get to Alabama, you've hit the gold mine. There are really a plethora of resources. So we visit Selma, Montgomery. We take a side afternoon trip to Tuskegee. And then we also visit Birmingham before we go back to the University of Mississippi at Oxford, and then end our trip in Memphis. And so that is our route. If you were taking a family trip, I have personally taken my children, who at the time were middle school and elementary school ages, to Montgomery, and found that to be a really good trip, particularly for the younger your children are. You almost have to limit the intake of information. They just can't quite absorb it all. So to pick one particular city to go and to enjoy that city, I think would be the best bet for children.
Are they getting this history in school? Because I have to say, my kids, they're all in good schools, but they're sort of like a little stuff for Black History Month, a little stuff about Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, and then the rest of it is it doesn't seem like it's a primary focus in at least my experience of Texas public schools.
It's not, and the Texas case is particularly controversial because we're the second largest market for textbooks, and so sort of right. set the trend. And that has gotten totally politicized as to what goes in the textbooks. I would recommend going to the website of the Southern Poverty Law Center. And they have graded the public education system in each state of the Union and their coverage of the civil rights. And interestingly enough, Alabama and Mississippi rank pretty high on their content. Simply, if you think about it, they have more African Americans in the state legislatures who are speaking out that these issues have to be incorporated. So that is a contemporary political controversy as to fighting for the content of what is in the history books.
Where does Texas rank, curiously? Do you remember?
It probably ranks middling.
Okay. Well, folks can look that up on the yeah. Southern Poverty Law Center website.
I'd be interested to know what Emily's experiences were as a high school and middle school student. Was this history included? Of course, I know you went to private school mm-hmm. for some or all of that, but what was your exposure to this history?
I went to Ursuline Academy here in Dallas, but I, even at a private high school, I feel like the history that we were taught was very much what we like to call in class the dominant narrative, mm-hmm. what Ray was saying, how Rosa Parks sat down and Martin Luther King stood up and he gave a speech. And you kind of just touch on it a little bit through your American history class. There's not really much in depth that you go into, maybe a little bit more at a private university. But myself, I feel like I didn't receive as much education as I would have hoped. Now being a human rights major at SMU, I'm so passionate about these kinds of classes. And Professor Simon's class is really the first class I've taken at SMU that really digs deep into the American Civil Rights Movement. And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to take this class and go on this trip, because I feel like I couldn't really speak about human rights as well without knowing this part of history. And I feel like it's a big chunk of history that I never learned.
Did you get a deeper sense, Emily, on this trip for the self-discipline on the part of thousands of people that it took to stay committed to the principles of nonviolent resistance, given what so many people were up against?
It was, yes, nonviolence. I think all of us, we kind of, as students, think, like, how could you not want to act violently? And when we met some of the people who were involved in the movement, especially the younger people like Joanne Bland when she was just a kid, and some other foot soldiers who were teenagers at the time, they openly told us, like, you know, I didn't get involved in some of these major organizations because I couldn't keep that nonviolent promise mm-hmm. because it was very difficult, I think, especially as a young person, to see all these injustices happen around you, to your parents and to your siblings and your friends. And you kind of reflect and you think, well, what would I have done? Would I have been nonviolent? And you'd like to think that you would have taken that pledge, but it's very hard to put yourself in that kind of place in history and think what you would have done.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hello, good afternoon. I'd like to share an experience with you.
Okay.
That I had in international boarding school in Vermont. Now, these are two guys, one black, one white. They're very good friends. They come back after Christmas break, and the white kid from Georgia hangs a Confederate flag in the room.
Hmm.
The black guy from Bermuda goes into the room. And keep in mind, these guys are very good friends. And, you know, I would say he freaks out, and that's putting it nicely. So, you know, a kid from Georgia feels like this isn't anything racial. This is just states' rights, history, you know, Georgia pride. But I don't think that people from the North and people of African descent are going to see the Southern flag, the Confederate flag that way. And I want to challenge our guests to have a more definitive answer that, you know, the Confederate flag really is a symbol of racial oppression and hatred and not just, you know, states' rights.
Anyone want to jump in there? I mean, people are upset by this. Am I right? I suppose there's no way to prove a negative, right? There's no way to prove if the Confederate flag is invoked that it is not sort of coded racism.
Exactly right. And again, that's an interpretation that is held by a significantly large and important group. And we have yet, I think, broadly speaking in this country, learned how to talk to one another about these kinds of issues. And so it's just states' rights and tradition. It's offensive. Get together and find out why. And, you know, verbally fight it out and gain the other perspective and an appreciation for why that is seen as offensive. That's something we're not good at.
I know that churches are sort of a recurring theme along the way, and they're an interesting subject to me because churches in the Deep South, on the one hand, were sometimes part of the solution, and on the other hand, there were other congregations that were very much sort of reinforcing the status quo.
The black church in particular, I think, is an important institution to look at when you look at civil rights in the South and the civil rights movement generally, because it was historically the only institution where African Americans could gather themselves. It was a cultural hub. It was a social hub. It had elements of organization that African Americans did not enjoy in other parts of social life. And so we see that in the beginning, every black church was not on board. They're burning churches. They're killing parishioners. And there were a lot of pastors and administrative boards and congregations who was really unsure if they could be a part of that. And also there was a theological debate whether a church should be that engaged in civic affairs or in theology it's called this worldly or other worldly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, should our focus be on the world to come and the peace and
just
the comfort.
Just get your soul ready.
Get your bags packed. But there's also a saying that sometimes you're so heavenly minded that you're no earthly good.
Hmm.
And so Dr. King and many other prominent ministers were very pivotal in making that change in the black church in particular. That how can you not be concerned with your parishioners in their everyday life and the barriers that they face?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to David in Fort Worth. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Great,
good
thank
show.
You.
Thank you very much for that. Question I have is that I worked and lived in East St. Louis for a long time. I'm a white guy, and I'm always amazed every time I go through that city that it continues to deteriorate and deteriorate and deteriorate. And I'm sure it's like 90% black. And I wonder why that has been allowed to keep going on in a downward spiral for all these years.
I'm not sure if that's something that our guests have really looked at. Is anyone familiar with East St. Louis and the situation there?
Not East St. Louis specifically, but I think the caller brings up a valid point that after integration, we started to see urban decay in ways that we had not seen it previously. And it's become a kind of a part of our vernacular now that we call it white flight. So there were a variety of school districts who refused to integrate. There were districts that literally the mayor or the governor said, we will not have school this academic year. And because of those decisions, because of the refusal to integrate, we see the appearance of Christian schools and charter schools and private schools that developed during that time period. And we see suburbs becoming a place of refuge or haven for white families who did not want to integrate. And so when your tax base and so much of your talent leaves in great numbers, then what you often have is urban decay.
One thing, and Emily, you could respond to this, that we learned about too. Our route takes us through the rural South, and what immediately strikes you is that poverty is colorblind. Some of our students have never seen what rural poverty looks like. Mm-hmm. And if you're going on backcountry roads to a destination, you see it up close.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my dad's side of the family is from New Orleans, and I've spent some time along coastal Mississippi, but I had never been to that part of the country before in what's called the Black Belt, the rural southern part of Mississippi and Alabama. And one thing, though, that when Stephen Black touched upon in our talk, he talked a lot about our misconceptions of poverty levels in the U.S. and the race element to poverty, and how the majority of Americans assume that those majority of African Americans are in poverty, when the reality is African Americans only make up, 16-17% of the entire U.S. population, and out of that, only at the highest has been African Americans made up 30% of the poverty level. So you have this misconception of how race affects poverty and how that legislation affects poverty laws, and what Dr. Simon said, though. It is really obvious that this is a part of our country that has been neglected.
Emily Mankowski is an SMU junior majoring in human rights who went on this year's civil rights pilgrimage. Ray Jordan is a leader of the trip, and Dennis Simon is Altshuler, distinguished teaching professor of political science at SMU. Thank you so much to all of you for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. Email any comments or suggestions or questions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.